terrorism. The deadly knife attack comes as France is mired in an escalating row with Muslim nations over Macron's highly controversial approach towards Islam and Muslims in France. The row has been fueled by Macron's defense of cartoons depicting the Prophet Muhammad, which Muslims consider blasphemous. The French president says free speech and secular values are his red lines. He has pledged to push ahead with his plan to combat, quote, Islamist separatism. The French president insists that Islam is in crisis all over the world and that radical Muslim positions are hardening. Muslim leaders and scholars have condemned terrorist attacks in France, but have warned that provocative comments by Macron are fueling hatred and extremism. Muslims argue that a line must be drawn between free speech and insult to religions. Meanwhile, the United Nations warned on Thursday that insulting religions provokes violent extremism, leading to fragmentation of the society. But Macron is not listening at all. Why is he refusing to see that his deeply divisive statements are somehow destroying what's left of tolerance in the French society? The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, called the French president's defense of the blasphemous cartoons a stupid act. The leader said French people should ask their president why he supports insulting God's messenger in the name of freedom of expression. Iran's foreign minister Mohammad Javad Zarif condemned the terrorist attack in Nice. Zarif said hate speech, provocations and violence must be replaced by reason and sanity. Meanwhile, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, who has been outspoken in his condemnation of Macron, says Western countries attacking Islam want to relaunch the Crusades. Pakistani Prime Minister Imran Khan urged Muslim leaders this week to act collectively to counter growing Islamophobia in non-Muslim states. Anti-France sentiments are running high in Muslim countries around the globe. There have been protests in many Muslim countries, including Indonesia, Pakistan, Iraq, Syria, and Libya, which drew hundreds of thousands of demonstrators. Traders and people in many countries are boycotting French goods in response to France's anti-Islam campaign. Politicians in Europe have, however, been reluctant to acknowledge that radical statements and stances by top European officials are fueling the flames of extremism. Many European leaders have rallied around Macron and criticized attacks on him. The ongoing tensions may abate in the coming days or weeks, but they are likely to rise again in the future if politicians and top officials fail to respect religions and listen to reason.
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Unity Week.
Unity Week.
the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful. Welcome to the fifth part of the special series on Unity Week that spans 12th to 17th of the Islamic month of Rabiul Awwal, marking the birthday anniversary of the Messenger of Mercy, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Hope we will be true followers of the Holy Prophet and to meet him in Paradise. The Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him, in Sermon 26 of the Nahj al-Balagha, describes the society of the era of ignorance, the era before the advent of Islam, as, "O group of Arabs, you lived in the worst houses. You didn't live the life of a human. You were beside biting snakes. You drank fetid water. You ate unpleasant food. You killed each other. You severed human bonds. Idols were set up among you, and sins and pollution had engulfed you." Dear listeners, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, started his mission in such a society. Thus, mankind is indebted to him till the end of history. Now we are going to mention a few statements from Western, non-Muslim intellectuals and thinkers about the unmatched personality of the Prophet of Islam. The German scholar Anne-Marie Schimmel believed that the picture of Islam and the Prophet of Islam had been tarnished since the medieval Europe. Anne-Marie Schimmel got her PhD in Persian and Turkish languages in 1941 and got her PhD in the history of religions in 1951. Schimmel then taught in divinity at the University of Ankara in Turkey and also taught Islamic languages and history, history of religions in Germany and the United States. She had good mastery over different Oriental languages and penned more than 100 books and articles on Islamic mysticism and the notables of the Islamic world. Professor Anne-Marie Schimmel wrote in her book, "Prophet Muhammad stood up. God shone his light that is not limited to time and place through the Prophet. He is the illuminating light that has appeared from the unseen world and manifested in the universe." Anne-Marie Schimmel stood against those who tried to besmirch the image of the Prophet of Islam. She said, "It is a matter of regret for me that the Western circles cast a negative look at Islam. Islam enjoys a lofty position which should be considered more closely. The Muhammadian religion has attracted the hearts of hundreds of millions of people, and it is the religion of peace, calm, and justice." Anne-Marie Schimmel praises the Prophet of Islam in another chapter of her book. She says, "In fact, obeying Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, matters because he was pure from any flaw and mistake and never allowed the dust of sin to cover his clean soul. Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, is the perfect man who has harnessed instincts and carnal desires. In every moment of life, he put into practice the teachings of God with correct thought and correct action, and he caused devil to surrender to his invincible will. Muhammad was overwhelmed by the sea of contemplation and in quest of something loftier than the religion of that time, when suddenly the divine revelation was sent down to him and encompassed him. The characteristics of Muhammad are so unique that scholars stress that in order to glorify and venerate him, he shouldn't be compared with rulers, politicians, and worldly officials. Leo Tolstoy, the renowned Russian writer and intellectual, loved Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Tolstoy wrote a book on the Prophet titled Muhammad. He also gathered some of the statements of the Prophet and published them in Russia. He writes, "There is no doubt that the Prophet of Islam was among the great reformers of the world, the reformer who has rendered remarkable services to the human community. This pride is sufficient for him that he relived a blood-shedding and savage nation from the clutches of demons and heinous habits, and opened the way of progress for them, while a usual man cannot embark on such a great job. Thus, the personality of the Prophet of Islam deserves every kind of respect and veneration." Elsewhere in his remarks, Leo Tolstoy admits the rationality and the logic of Islam, saying, "Islam, due to its compliance with wisdom and intellect, will take over the entire world." The Scottish intellectual and writer Thomas Carlyle writes on the Prophet of Islam, "I love Muhammad because of his sincerity. He had no hypocrisy, he had no deception and no show-off in his affairs. This child of the desert had an independent view and an honest nature. He was insightful and radiant. He had no haughtiness, yet he was not abject. He was a great man by nature. The Quran was conveyed through his tongue and impacted others. Although he had not studied, hadn't gone to school or seen a teacher, he didn't need them. He was like a blade that was needless of sharpening." Thomas Carlyle extols the human virtues of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, and tells ill-wishers, "Brothers, have you ever seen an impostor who is so powerful to fabricate a religion and spread it across the world? By God, a liar and an ignorant person cannot build a house. It is impossible for him to build a house where millions of Muslims have lived for 14 centuries. Had the liar built this house, it would have collapsed and perished. Alas, how shameful these whims are, how miserable and weak the owners of these thoughts are. I can see by looking at history that honesty and righteousness are the basis of the Prophet's life and all of his works and virtues." The British writer Karen Armstrong believes that life without faith is meaningless. Karen Armstrong wrote the book Muhammad after September 11, 2001. Her book was the bestseller in the United States. What motivated her to write the book was to defend Islam and clarify the image of the Prophet for the Western mind. Karen Armstrong says, "I have written this book because I was concerned that the image of Muhammad would only be the one that Salman Rushdie had presented to the Western people, because I found Muhammad one of the rare figures of human history. The life of the Prophet of Islam had been planned according to the revelation and fulfilling the true commands of God by organizing a humane society." Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, strove for eradication of ignorance and succeeded to unify and integrate the shattered Arabia, a job that was incredible for many at that time. Karen Armstrong maintains that Knowing the true image of the Prophet of Islam is quintessential in this period of human history, as fanatics and bigoted people exploit his character through distortion. The French intellectual Voltaire writes, "Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, was undoubtedly a very great man, and he raised great men with his merit and perfection too. He was a wise legislator, an able conqueror, a just ruler, and a pious messenger, and he staged the greatest revolution on earth." It is a matter of deep regret that writers and staff of the French magazine Charlie Hebdo, who have sold out their soul and dignity to the Zionists and Americans, publish blasphemous cartoons of the Holy Prophet of Islam in the name of freedom of expression. Insulting the sanctities of nearly 2 billion Muslims worldwide is freedom of expression, but any research or doubt about the myth of Holocaust is deemed as a crime and will face punishment.
Hi everyone, this is John. You're with me for another episode of our weekly show, The Subcontinent. Our program focuses on few of the most critical, sensitive, and important issues in the subcontinent, a region which hosts almost 25% of the global population. So let's dive into our segment, break down issues, take expert opinion, and see what people say. Please stay with us.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we shall look into China-Pakistan economic belt. Also, we will explore India's fight against digital colonization.
The China-Pakistan Economic Corridor, or CPEC, is a multi-billion dollar infrastructure development project intended to connect Asia with Europe, the Middle East, and Africa. It was officially launched in April 2015 while China's President Xi Jinping visited Pakistan with an estimated cost of about $46 billion. Then the two governments drew up a long-term plan starting in 2017 and drastically expanded the projected timeline for implementation up to 2030. Projected costs ballooned to $62 billion, but Pakistani officials have since mentioned even higher numbers.
Pakistan is struggling with persistent security issues and infrastructure shortages. Therefore, attracting foreign investment is truly difficult. This is when old friend China enters the stage with unexpected largesse to strengthen their ties. Ties once described higher than the Himalayas, deeper than the deepest ocean, and sweeter than honey. Naturally, Islamabad accepts the helping hand, and Pakistan becomes a natural location for China to pilot its ambitious Belt and Road Initiative, BRI. China-Pakistan Economic Corridor, CPEC, launched in 2015 to address Pakistan's persistent power sector and infrastructure woes, is the most developed section of the Belt and Road Initiative to date, connecting Western China with the Arabian Sea via Balochistan. For Pakistan, the project is advertised as a game-changer that will take Pakistan to new heights of prosperity because of the numerous opportunities it promised to create. But for China, the stakes seem to be even higher because the project is a showcase for the promises or perils of the mother project to other countries. If China succeeds in this part, garnering support for the Belt and Road Initiative may become more realizable.
Since the Chinese President Xi Jinping launched the initiative in 2013, the World Bank estimates about $575 billion worth of energy plants, railways, roads, ports and other projects have been built or are in the process of being worked all across the globe. Islamabad hopes to use the Chinese capital, production capacity, and know-how from the project in order to upgrade the country's infrastructure and build a mechanism for sustainable growth development. In return, Beijing gains a connection to the Arabian Sea, providing a contingency trade route to the risk-prone Malacca Strait. The narrow stretch of water between the Malay Peninsula and the Indonesian island of Sumatra is the main shipping lane between the Indian Ocean and the Pacific Ocean.
Apart from a patchy portrayal of feasibility for the Belt and Road Initiative, the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor is supposed to serve another agenda for Beijing. Through financing the project, China aims to promote its currency. A goal failed so far, as all of the transactions have been made in US dollars instead of yuan. Of course, it was Pakistan, not China, that initially pushed for jettisoning the greenback. Recently, however, there has been a renewed push to look for alternatives to dollar-based project financing and expansion of the renminbi in Sino-Pakistani cross-border trade. Last fall, the two countries announced that renminbi would replace dollar to finance all future energy and transport projects placed under the CPEC umbrella. Pakistan is a flagship for China's Belt and Road, so the need to show progress is crucial, but the progress is increasingly slowing down, if not paralyzed, as some think tanks label it. Why? Probably because BRI's practicality is undermined by accusations that China is luring poor countries into debt traps for its own gain. Pakistan's cluttered political economy, austerity measures imposed by the International Monetary Fund, and now COVID-19 have been other hurdles in the way of the project.
Now for more insight, we are joined by Mr. Shakil Ahmed Rameh, who is a political economist. Mr. Rameh, welcome to the subcontinent. So, what does China-Pakistan Economic Corridor mean for the relations between Pakistan and China? What would it bring for both the countries?
First of all, Pakistan and China see each other iron brother. So this is a terminology which both countries don't use for any other country. So there you can see how much importance they give to each other. Second thing, so CPEC and China and relationship, they are bringing enormous opportunities for Pakistan and China. First of all, in case of Pakistan, so before launch of the CPEC, Pakistan was going through energy crunch. Every year, Pakistan was losing $4 to $5 billion due to load shedding of electricity. There was huge demand for the road and transport infrastructure. Pakistan needed $1.2 billion to rehabilitate the transport sector, but Pakistan did not have the resources. On top of that, Pakistan was going through the war on terror, and no country, and even our allies, they were not offering us any type of investment and any type of help to overcome these challenges. In this case, China came forward to help us. Or for China, through CPEC route, if China only do trade with the six countries, including Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, Netherlands, Germany, France, China can save $70 billion in the transportation. That's why it is called a win-win cooperation.
Okay, what is the significance of the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor for India?
If India become part of CPEC, India can fulfill its dream of connectivity toward Afghanistan and to Central Asia. You know that India always look for the transit trade through Pakistan to reach Afghanistan and Central Asia, but they have problem. Being a part of CPEC, they can utilize the CPEC route to do the trade with the Afghanistan and the Central Asian state. On other side, if the India join the BRI Belt and Road Initiative through another corridor, Bangladesh, China, Myanmar, and India, so they can officially create link with the CPEC. So they can again use the CPEC route by using the BRI to go for the transit trade with the Central Asia and with Afghanistan. One thing and second thing, India need huge investment for its infrastructure. as we know that there is a problem of infrastructure, there is a problem. When I talk about the infrastructure, it does not only mean road infrastructure, something like that. It also includes education infrastructure, health infrastructure, and other services infrastructure. But India is not able to put forward that money. So they need some assistance from the other country. So it will also bring these opportunities for India to benefit from BRI and also from the Asia Infrastructure and Investment Bank, which has been hosted by China.
Mr. Rame, our team has collected some global media coverages in this regard, and I would appreciate if you could take a look, and then we can continue with the question and answer session.
The reality is that much of CPEC, like the Belt and Road more broadly, has been paralyzed, said Jonathan Hillman, a senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, referring to the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor. Pakistan is a flagship for China's Belt and Road, so the need to show progress is even more important. China needed a country to showcase its BRI initiative. Pakistan seemed the obvious choice. It was China's only real ally, a security partner, or a vulnerable flank. Meanwhile, a new prime minister, Nawaz Sharif, and his business-friendly Pakistan Muslim League had just come to power, pledging big infrastructure projects and an end to the country's notorious brownouts.
Welcome back, Mr. Rame, and thank you to the audience as well for staying with us. So, can this project be used to counter the hegemony of the US dollar?
Look, to counter the hegemony, it will take time, at least 3 to 4 decades. China wants to work with the global system, but definitely as the time will go on, China will be the strongest country in the term of economy and its outreach to the BRI. But definitely when they will be the hub of all the economic activities, people will prefer to work with the Chinese currency instead of with US currency.
There are reports of this project being delayed. So what is the reason for the delay of the implementation of this project?
Project is going well, but there are certain challenges or the problem which project is facing from the day one. First of all, the external challenges, the propaganda by the West, especially led by USA and India, because in USA never wanted Pakistan to be the part of the CPAC. That's why they're using a different tools, including FATF. So they have put Pakistan in a gray list by using one way and another way. So it can hinder the investment in the Pakistan. Second thing, that Indians dream of the regional hegemony. It's also creating problem for the Pakistan because Pakistan is not ready to accept the India as a hegemonic power in the region. And other thing is on the internal level. So at internal level, some of the political parties, they are busy to take the credit of the CPAC. If you talk to any political party of the Pakistan, they say, oh, it's due to us. But the reality is that China built this relationship with all the governments from 1952 onward. So this CPAC corridor is a result of the continuous work of all the political parties and the institution from the both sides, from China and Pakistan. So nobody can take a credit. But due to this credit game, so when somebody is not in the government, they start to raise the questions, which impact, definitely they are the part of the parliament. So it's impact the speed of a CPAC. But alhamdulillah, at this point of time, CPAC is going very well. With the creation of the CPAC authority, the speed has been accelerated. We are witnessing every day a new project and a new dimensions in the CPAC. The CPAC has been now expanded in the area of agriculture, cooperation, and science and technology.
Thank you so much, Mr. Rame, for being with us on our show. Let's see how people on social media see the situation now.
As the spokesperson of China's Ministry of Foreign Affairs, Li Jianzhao considers the CPEC project as the flagship of the BRI and believes that it has boosted Pakistan's economy and regional connectivity. Imtiaz Butt believes that CPEC plays an important role in expanding trade potential by connecting China to other parts of Asia and also the Arabian Sea and the Persian Gulf. The official account of the CPEC project refers to the report published by the State Bank of Pakistan that China has poured $103.6 million during the first quarter of the ongoing fiscal year, consolidating its first position as topmost FDI country in Pakistan.
Colonialism means when a country seeks to extend or retain its authority over other people or territories. Now that the age is digital, control over how technology works is the foundation of colonialism. Western big tech firms are reinventing colonialism through the domination of digital technology, exercising imperial control at the architectural level of the digital ecosystem. The current state of affairs is reminiscent of the European colonial era prior to World War I, but the actors have swapped roles. Now the US is exerting global power instead of European superpower.
This is a special coverage of a live event.
The speech, which is going to be delivered by leader of Islamic Revolution Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei on the occasion of the birth anniversary of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Let's take a listen.
Felicitations to all the respected viewers, the Iranian nation, and the entire great Islamic community, the occasion of the auspicious occasion of the birth anniversary of the great prophet of Islam, Muhammad, peace be upon him, and also the auspicious birth anniversary of Imam Ja'far Sadiq. This is a great Muslim festivity, and it just laid the groundwork for the appointment to prophethood of the Prophet. That's the greatest and epical history-making point for humanity ever. So hopefully this festivity and Eid occasion will be a great and blessing to all Islamic community, the Iranian nation, also for human community. It would be a source of multitudes of blessings. Well, today we have three occasions concurrently, one being the auspicious birth anniversary of the Prophet, endeared Prophet of Islam, and his grandson Imam Ja'far Sadiq. We have another occasion, the beginning of the Unity Week, which is also of paramount importance. We also have the 13th of Aban, Iranian calendar, that falls on November 3rd. That's the day of fighting the global arrogance. Now, regarding each of these, I will make a few points and comments addressing the Iranian nation. As for the great Prophet of Islam, peace be upon him, there are many Quranic verses. Some of them very clearly deal with and has to do with what's happening in the world today now. As if when you're reading those verses, it's as if those verses have been revealed to the Prophet for mankind living at this time and age. One of them is this verse in the Bara'at chapter that says, in Arabic, we appointed a respected person from among yourselves who is kind to and compassionate to the faithful and believers. The first two statements of the verse addresses the entire human community. And in the following verse, it says, O people, I'm a prophet descended upon you. That's the entire humanity that's being addressed by a prophet of Islam. So these two statements are really important. That means the person who is respected, the person who does the suffering of human being costs the Prophet dearly. So he suffers from your suffering. And then he is compassionate, he is kind to you, he is keen on your destiny, a good destiny for you. This is, again, this has to do with the entire humanity. So today, the human community is actually being addressed by this Quranic verse. I mean, this is directly proportionate with the status quo of human society these days. Human being today, you can say that more than any other time in history, humanity is undergoing immense suffering. You can see inequality, see warmongering, and extremist materialism. And this has been unprecedented to this extent. I mean, this kind of material inclination among human society is that intensely. You seldom seen that. The use of science and technology in order to repress the people, rebellion, and treachery, all of these, you have inequality, discrimination, injustice. This always existed in the course of history. It doesn't belong to today, but these days they're using the lovers of science and technology in order to exercise this satanic power. The Pharaoh, for instance, would say that within the realm of Egypt, he would do whatever wrong he wanted to do. But today, America, that's the very same Pharaoh of today. They do not suffice to America only. They do not say that I'm ruling you and I want to do to you. They go to other countries. They start wars there. They try to wield hegemony there. They make bases there. So that's what the situation is like. And making use and taking advantage of human knowledge and science, and this is what the global arrogant powers are doing. Warmongering, you see, is happening more than any other time. So the Prophet of Islam, as the Quran says, his pure soul and spirit suffers from this human suffering. And that he wants to see prosperity of humanity. He wants to see humanity guided the right way. Well, the Prophet was a kind father par excellence. He wants to see humanity moving on the right path, and he wants to see humanity attain the right destiny. Now, one point in this Quranic verse, this appears at the end of the Bara'at chapter. Bara'at chapter is a chapter of war. It means deliverance from infidels and pagans, that enjoins you to join the battles and fight the infidels. At the end of the chapter, it says, as I told you, that it addresses the whole nation, the entire public. So there's a lesson and point that could be drawn from this, and that's the this is related to masses of it's not non-Muslim, actually, masses and crowds. It also relates to the leaders and rulers of the arrogants and pagans. Now, those establishments that rule the destiny of human society, the Quran calls them leaders of infidels. Well, that's what the Quran says in Arabic, that they are leading the people toward the hell and inferno. That's what they're doing, those leaders and rulers. So that intensity that the Quran, in the face of pagans and infidels, that's what it's expressing about these people. So the masses of non-believers and infidels, those who, and actually those who are following justice, those who have no antagonism and no ill wishes, they are those who are being addressed by that graceful statement that says Prophet suffers from your suffering. Now, today the enemy of the Islam, the main enemies, are those leaders who invite the people to hell. These are the global arrogance and the world Zionism. These are the ones that are actually fighting and confronting Islam with full force. So the last demonstration of this antagonism was what you saw happen in Paris last week, unfortunately. That was a horrible performance in Paris that should be contemplated upon. Well, there was this caricature. Well, a caricaturist did something wrong, and then they cursed the Prophet of Islam in the language of drawing a caricature. Well, it doesn't mean that an artist has gone awry and has done something wrong. That's not only this point. It's not confined to this. It's not behind this. There are some hands and gloves. And what's the reason for this? The reason is that you all of a sudden see that in defense of this, let's say something, some normal artwork, a president, for instance, a head of a government, stands by that, and some other governments go for its support. That means there are people behind this. It just merely doesn't mean that this is an art of France that has faced decadence and reached this point. It means it's policy. It's the establishment that's backing and advocating this wrong deed. So the political figure goes there and expressly announces his advocacy for this. Well, you are saying that this man has killed a person. So, okay, for the victim, you can sympathize with the victim. You can feel sorrow and regret. So, why do you get these caricatures posted everywhere and installed somewhere, and you assert your open support for that? This is a bitter incident. This is a horrible thing that's happening at the level of a government. It just does not mean that there was only an artist or a caricaturist who did this. That's not all about it. Last time, when the same thing happened, we saw the same story, the same saga. Again, there were some political figures and personalities who came to the fore, and they supported that move. Of course, this is the Islamic community is enraged, and they're opposing. This shows the vibrant Islamic community that they're aware they're across the Islamic spectrum, the Islamic world, the people, politicians, and scholars, many of them, of course. Some of them, again, have shown how humiliated they are, how mean they are. Of course, the majority of Muslims and Muslim scholars and politicians, they have defended the Islamic identity, the Prophet of Islam, and they have expressed their outrage. This shows that the people are awake. But there is a lesson to be drawn, and this is part of the points that we should be heeded by those who have to do with politics in the world. So the French government here relates this to human rights and the different kinds of freedoms and so on and so forth. This is where you should contemplate and learn. Now, what kind of a government is the French government? What kind of policy is that policy? This is the very same policy that is the fiercest, that is the most savage and brutal terrorists of the world have been harbored. France is where the terrorists, those kind of terrorists, have sought shelter. Those who assassinated our president, our prime minister, the head of judiciary in Iran, they are the very same terrorists. And the lots of members of parliament, members of judiciary, and also on top of 17,000 of people in the streets, that's based on the statistics that we have available. People in the street, martyred them all. These are not average terrorists. And where do they harbor? France, Paris. And these people are talking about human rights and freedoms. Now, the very same government, when it comes to Saddam, like a ferocious wolf, we can call him, this government offered him the greatest assistance during the Saddam-imposed war. You cannot say it was a greater assistance compared to other foreign countries, but one of the largest contributors to the Saddam war against Iran was France, advanced weaponry, fighter jets, and military hardware. That was what friends provided that ferocious wolf with, and they simply acknowledged that they had done the same thing. They didn't feel embarrassed about it. So that's how they dealt with terrorists, and regarding their own people, the way they behave toward the Middle East. You see, on Saturdays, you remember the past 1 year, they haven't said, you saw what the way they behaved toward their own people and the way they dealt with yellow vest protests on Saturdays. And then they claim of human rights and freedom. So I'm of the belief that they are two sides of the same coin. I mean, defending savagery, cultural savagery, and then, I mean, that criminal act committed by terrorists, defending such a deed is one side. The other side of the coin is defending for the terrorists and dictators like Saddam Hussein. They are two sides of the same coin. Well, in European countries and in America, the same thing has happened. I mean, insulting the Quran, insulting the Prophet of Islam. Several times, the same thing has happened in different points in the West and in America and in Europe. That has been repeated. But these cannot actually hurt and dent the dignity and magnanimity of the Islamic Prophet in any way, in the slightest way. This is pretty apparent that the enlightened face of the Prophet of fiction is not dented in any way. His face will shine even more brilliantly, like the hooligans and hoodlums in Mecca at the time of the Prophet of Islam. They tried their best, but they could not conceal the reputation of the Prophet of Islam. So this, the same thing is being repeated. History is being repeated. These people, these days, they cannot do anything about it. I mean, they cannot do anything. They cannot harm the Prophet of Islam in any way. But there is only one point that we should notice, and that this is an indication of the nature, the brutal nature of the Western civilization. This indicates the fact that this civilization, this culture, inherently, it has, this is modern ignorance, actually, that has to do with oppression and savagery and brutality. Of course, they hide this savagery, they conceal it, because science, knowledge, and technology, they make the avail of that. So they cover that up by technology and by knowledge, and they cover savagery underneath that cover. And they talk, they wear this human face, and they use, they wear perfumes, you know, they wear ties, and they try to appear neatly, and they dress up to the nines, but they try to cover those savagery and brutality underneath all this facade. Well, the Prophet of Islam is not, his reputation is not dented in any way. This is only a way for us to get to better get to know this culture, which is really a brutal one, a savage one. This is what has beset their own nation after several centuries, since the beginning of this, the advent of this civilization, since the Renaissance, I mean. You see what the situation is like: inequality, poverty, you see injustice, you see the embarrassing moral decadence that you see in corruption in Europe and in America, and the followers. You can see what's happening there. This is the nature, this is inherent in this civilization. So let's go to the second point, the Unity Week. Well, I believe that today, more than any other time, the significance of this great initiative of the late Imam Khomeini is being evident to us. And the day when the late Imam Khomeini designated the Week of Unity, and he stressed the unity among Islamic denominations in their directions and their social and cultural standpoints. That day, lots of those people who were addressed by this message, at that time, they could not feel how significant this message was. We can make a mention of some of the leaders of Islamic countries. They did not comprehend how important the message was. Many people did not comprehend this, did not get the message. Many of them just had some ill wishes, and they did not. They just simply wanted to ignore it. So today we just come to realize how significant that message has been, what's happened today. All these different kinds of divisions and differences that you see among Muslim countries, these horrible instances, incidents that has happened in some countries like in Syria, in Iraq, in Libya, in Yemen, in Afghanistan. Now what's happened in these countries, when you look at those incidents, you see how significant unity was among the Islamic countries and how valuable a blessing that has been. That's what the late Imam Khomeini asked for. If unity had existed, lots of these, what happened, would not happen today. So many things is happening in the specific the Muslim world, especially the part of the Muslim community in this world. What's happening is catastrophic, partly. The issue of Palestine, the cause of Palestine, was faded away. The treacherous move, the humiliating move of normalizing relations with the Zionists, that was launched. Well, all of these are the reason behind all of this is the lack of unity among the Muslim countries. You know, there is this rivalry among them. They have erroneous incentives for their decisions, so, and they made such a wrong decision, and they plundered, and they trample upon the Palestinians' rights. Of course, this is not going to come to an end. I mean, they cannot. They're too mean to be able to put an end to the cause of Palestine. The cause of Palestine will persist, will go on. Palestine will be Palestine, and the Zionist regime, fabricated Zionist regime, will go away. No doubt about it. But they are simply making obstructions in the way to the best of their ability. So this relation with the killer and usurper regime, the Zionist regime, the criminal regime, they have usurped the land. They have killed the people. How many Palestinians, you see, they have killed, and how many sorts of different crimes they have committed. They establish relations with such a regime, and they are pleased, and they are proud of this, and they simply come up with some justifications for doing so. So the point I want to make is that this initiative, unfortunately, many Muslim countries and many audience, they did not understand how significant that was. But the enemy did so. The enemy realized that this recommendation of the late Imam Khomeini, that's unity among Islamic denominations in their policies and their strategies. They can keep their own faith, their own ideologies, whatever way they believe in. They can have their own rituals, their own special way. But when it comes to overall, let's say, posturing and stances, unity, how important that is for the Muslim community and how the enemy influence would be mitigated that way. That's what the enemy recognized and realized, and that's why they tried to plan against this, and they came up with some schemes, with some practical schemes that the enemy came up with in order to confront the message of unity of the late Imam Khomeini. Well, creating centers for production of some thoughts that would be divisive. You know, we're talking about proximity of Islamic denominations. We're talking about such a thing. They came up with some centers. They paid some mercenaries and they employed them there so that they could produce some thoughts and content in order to come up with ideas against this proximity and togetherness. So they wanted to act in such a way that this great prudence and wisdom of the late Imam Khomeini would be nullified. So they had think tanks acting against this, and they created Takfiri groups like this, the Daesh terrorist criminal group. And this is what the enemies of Islam created. Americans themselves confess. If we had made a claim, of course, you know, we had some information, we were informed, but if we had informed that they would cast it out, but that they themselves came up with a confession. I mean, those in the administration, when Daesh was created, they confessed, and also later on, the next administration, this person who is now at the helm of the White House, he expresses said that they themselves have created and have given rise to Daesh, and they supported the mercenaries in the region, the government, their cronies in the region. They were paid, they bought them weapons, and they gave them different kinds of facilities and possibilities. So they created think tanks, they also created terrorist groups and elements, and also those elements who did not know, actually didn't want to actually enter this game, they caught them by surprise, and unknowingly those also got involved, and they were enraged, and they made them, they set them off against one another. I mean, all of a sudden you see that in a certain country in our neighborhood, a scholar goes to the podium and then insults the other denomination, and then he goes to the British embassy and takes shelter there. I mean, this is what's happened just recently, and such a thing, we have so many instances like this. So they force the people to enrage the people and to set the people off against and pit them off against one another and create division. Well, they asserted that they have done that themselves. The point I want to make is that a number of governments in this region that are in charge of monetary support, they have committed a bigger sin than those groups that have joined them. I mean, people who from a corner of the Muslim community, they have their own, maybe out of ignorance or bias, they have joined the terrorist group. They have committed a smaller sin than the person, than the ruler or authority or the king in that state who pays them money and equips them with military hardware and weaponry. Of course, the main crime is attributed to Americans. In Takfiri, for example, operations, the main crime is should be attributed to Americans. Of course, there were some others. The Saudis also, they paid them and they supported them. In addition to committing this crime, the Americans also committed another crime, and that is that under the pretext of their presence in the region, they took soldiers to different their army all the way to Afghanistan. They deployed forces to Syria and other parts of the world. Some other countries also, they had been trying to deploy forces there, like Iraq, for instance. Of course, Iraqi youths will not allow that to happen because they have their own rightful decision that will prevent Americans from infiltrating there. But that's the scheme that they have in their mind, and they want also to find a footstep there. Wherever they went, they took with them instability and destruction. You can see in these countries, the infrastructure was destroyed, civil war was created, insecurity was perpetuated. No, they engaged the governments and the states in different things so that they would not be able to do their main job. So this is the really, they destroyed the whole generation. So in our opinion, Unity Week is really of the essence, and Muslim unity is the cure to many ailments of the and ills of the Islamic Muslim community. And this catastrophic Yemen war that you see, it's been 5 years they have been attacking this innocent people. They're killing them in bazaars and schools, at homes and in public places. They're being bombarded, and this is not a trivial thing. This is significant thing, you know. Saudis have been really acting brutally in Yemen, or the issue of Palestine. I mean, you have a number of mean and humiliated states that they have turned their back when they made a mockery of the Islamic community, and they actually, in their own whims and wishes, they ignored the cause of Palestine, and they stood by the side of the occupier and the criminal. On the back of unity of Muslim community, all of this would be addressed without a